It also reminds you then that you run into particular problems if over here you've got a subject matter and over here you've got a principle that you're going to apply there no matter what. That you run the danger that it doesn't really apply and therefore you're going to be saying something false. Or it really does apply, but if you're insisting on it too soon, you're going to apply it in the wrong way and create difficulty. The theories do have to be systematic and comprehensive, and therefore, if you've got something that you're going to preserve at all costs, it's liable to embarrass you because you can't take it in that form and still have it be part of a system. So there is that danger for a theorist. If he's too keyed to what it is a theory has to have, he may wind up with a theory that's not coherent, that's not systematic, that's not comprehensive, etc. But on the other hand, I said last time, that's the major division. If you insist on coherence, comprehensiveness, etc., you may have something that's irrelevant to your subject matter. And since you can't guarantee both, people do indeed tend to separate on which they're going to preserve at the price of which. As you can see, Allport clearly falls on the side of preserving what he already knows about people, in spite of the fact that he can't show it logically or scientifically. Whereas Freud had this neat little mechanism going, and it was a, if you look at it that way, a very nice, neat theory, and parsimonious to boot, but it led you to say things about people that just don't seem to be true. So you can say, well, you can see the kind of choice that people have or have had. It involves a sacrifice one way or the other. And it's a non-trivial sacrifice, as witness the fact that there are plenty of other people who are going to make the other sacrifice. Okay, is there any question about the principle of functional autonomy, where it fits into Allport's theory, what the analysis of the problem of things becoming other things is, and what the nature of the resolution of this particular one is? Higher capacity plus right kind of history. Now, it's that question that Allport had a kind of answer to when he says it's the appropriate strivings that are most important in generating functionally autonomous motives, the ones that really count. And that's where his anecdotal example of the guy who wants to become a physician and therefore his tastes, his interests, etc., become focused around and unified by his professional intent. And Allport wanted to say there, they really do become focused and they are genuine interests. It isn't that he does all of these with an ulterior motive of being a doctor. He really has all of these interests and they do go together then. Well, this notion of going together is one of Allport's other major concerns, namely consistency of people. And think again of a contrast. For Freud, if you asked, what kind of consistency do people show, the answer is going to be instinctual. They show consistency in that their behavior is instinctual, and they show consistency to the extent that they have learned regularities, fixations, etc. You look at that array and say, well, then it doesn't seem like a normal adult would have to be particularly consistent at all. Because the things he does are simply the accumulated effect of a lot of historical accidents. And those accidents don't have to take on any particular pattern. The most you can say is that there's certain weak connections, namely that a fixation of this sort or a characteristic of this sort will set limits to what else you can do or will create difficulties. But that's a very poor kind of consistency. It's not the kind that we normally think of when we say somehow, even though it's hard to say how, people are very consistent and their whole lives are consistent. They are not, their lives are not just a bunch of fragments. Their various behaviors are not just a set of behaviors. They somehow hang together. Well, Allport's, again, one of his a priori principles is that people are consistent. And some of the major apparatus of his system was to show how and to explain why. And here, interestingly enough, the concept that does the trick is once more the trait, but now a trait considered as an individual difference concept. And if you look, his definition of a trait is essentially the one that we gave. We're talking about traits, attitudes, values, and interests. In fact, his definition of traits, attitudes, and values is very, very similar to ours. What he didn't particularly do is connect them up, as we did, into variations from the same procedure. He simply introduced these as concepts to be used in doing research or in theorizing. Now, what Allport had was a kind of taxonomy. Recall the definition of a trait is that it renders stimuli functionally equivalent and initiates and guides equivalent forms of adaptive and expressive behavior. Now, you start with that definition and then you ask the Allport type question, namely, how many behaviors are expressions of a given trait? You recall that we did that too when we talked about a pattern of type of behavior and frequency of occurrence. Well, Allport is doing the same thing. He says, take the given trait, take the kind of behavior that expresses that trait, and now ask, how often does it occur in an individual's life? And his answer is, well, if you conceptually count these, then you can organize traits into a hierarchy based on the range, the number of behaviors in the individual's life that express them. And so you get a hierarchical arrangement of this sort. Now, this hierarchical arrangement corresponds to descriptions of behavior. For example, you can describe irritated behavior, and you can describe angry behavior, and you can describe resentful behavior, and say, okay, each of these reflects a fairly specific sort of trait. but there are differences among them, so we distinguish them. And you say, well, but if you look at all of them, all of them are expressions of a more general trait, namely hostility. And you look over here and you see other kinds of behavior, and you start out with the very specific ones and then go to the more general ones. And notice that if you go by logical generality, you are indeed going to have a circumstance where this one will apply to more behaviors. Why? Because it'll apply to all of the ones that any of these applies. So the more general the description, the more particular behaviors are going to be expressed by it.
Would Alford claim that those higher order traits were traits in the same way that the lower order traits, that they had to initiate that behavior?
Yeah.
That it wasn't just our own conceptual...
No, that's exactly what he wanted to deny. Remember, traits are something and they do something. Personality is something and it does something. He very definitely wanted to say it's not just our way of describing, it's out there, it's in you, it's what generates your behavior.
How can he distinguish between behavior that...
explanations. And Freud took one way out, namely a calculational type notion. Alport took a different way out, namely a content-free taxonomy. See, Alport did not have a list of the kind of traits people have. He simply says, you can arrange the behaviors in this way, and there will be traits of varying degrees of generality, and a given behavior will reflect or be the expression of one or more. He didn't say which traits. So that too is a way, you can see, a way out of the original bind of having a simple list and having it be by and large question begging. What he says is, well, we don't know what traits people have. We know some of them. And he was the one who looked in the dictionary and found 18,000 terms that were ID descriptions. He said, some of these are just purely made up. They're just our ways of talking, but others of them correspond to things that are really there. If you look at this and look at it from the point of view of the unity that it introduces, you'll see that it's a particular kind of unity. And if you look particularly at the top, you say, well, it's unified to the extent that there is a single one up here from which all other ones flow. To the extent that there's more than one, you still have consistency or unity problems. But of course, that's not quite as bad as simply saying, well, gee, there doesn't look to be any necessary consistency at all in people. What you're into then is saying, well, there doesn't really have to be complete consistency. But there's a whole lot of it. And operationally, it was a frequency and clarity. He says, well, different observers will differ as to how often they have to observe something and how unambiguously they have to observe something before they'll assign it to the expression of a trait. And you can see he's quite right. You would expect different observers to differ in that way. But this is in the context of saying, well, nevertheless, even though you get this kind of disagreement, for many, many traits, there really is something that corresponds to our way of talking. It isn't just our way of talking. Next, notice that what I said about generality holds only when you're within the same branch. If you've got this kind of arrangement, this one will always apply to at least as many cases as these will, because it includes them. On the other hand, if you compare across, say this one and this one, this may apply to more cases than this. For example, if a person is a hostile person, the number of occasions when he's irritated may far surpass the number of cases over here where he's being generous. So it's not simply the case that as you go up, you have more general descriptions and they apply to more behaviors. It's more flexible than that. And so you do indeed have to observe, and you can't just go by logical generality to see which are the dominant traits and which are the less dominant traits. Okay, so is there any question now about that this is a way of formulating a kind of consistency which is plausible in the sense that it reflects the kind of things that we do ordinarily notice about people? That noticing that here's a person who is often irritated or that he's usually generous, etc., is something that is quite familiar. There's no question that people do notice this sort of thing about people. And that's one of the kinds of things that they probably have in mind in saying people's behavior is consistent. There could be several, because there's no guarantee that there's only one. That's why I say that you're in a position of saying, well, people may not be completely consistent, but at least we know there's a lot of consistency, and here's a way of formulating. And I think Allport's stand was, if you really pursue this, you'll find that they're a lot more consistent than you might have thought. And we are constantly being surprised with new facts, which at first glance seem inconsistent, and later we're able to incorporate them as consistent. And that's where he then gets into the ideographic and morphogenic, that if you really knew his traits and knew what it meant to him, you'd probably see that it was completely consistent. But since we're forever barred from that kind of knowledge, our external approximations may leave some apparent inconsistency overall. The cardinal traits are his most general. Now, at the same time, down at the bottom, you get another definition in which he says the most specific trait is a bundle of habits. And the bundle of habits, guess what each habit is? It's one of our old familiar deeds.
Is that the most consistent or specific habit?
The most specific trait is a bundle of habits, or he says could be thought of as a bundle of habits. And this bundle consists of S's and R's. And these are the very two categories which, in the definition of a trait, had the equivalence notion attached to them. Remember, equivalent render stimuli functionally equivalent, and equivalent forms of behavior. So those equivalence references in the definition of trait shows up in this schema by saying the most specific trait is still itself complex. It is a complex of these things which really happen, namely stimulus-response connections. That the most specific trait is the smallest unit of meaningful description of people's behavior is itself complex because it refers to a bundle of other things of a different sort, which are what really happened. Remember in the definition, render stimuli functionally equivalent. And then generate, that is, initiate and guide equivalent forms of adaptive and expressive behavior. So it's in the S term and the R term that he has these equivalence conditions. And therefore, when he talks about bundles of habits, they are bundles of SR connections. And those are the very things that the reference to equivalence in the definition of trait does for him there.
What forms the bundle?
The functional equivalence. Yeah.
They're all functionally equivalent within one bundle.
Right. Okay. See, and there you get in probably the clearest possible form both the dilemma and the solution to how can a bunch of things that are really different be the same. The answer is they're a bundle. They're a bundle of functionally equivalent components. And so functionally they are the same, but actually they're different. And you can do that in terms of level of generality here. Now, as I say, this one will get you a lot of consistency, and it's the kind of situation where you can do as I think Alport did and say, I think that really there is complete consistency, even though we can't hope ever to be able to show it. But now we can say, let's suppose that there was complete consistency of this sort, and that you did indeed have everything with one final stem, a single cardinal trait. And we can ask, would that get us the kind of consistency that we want?
What the same type of thing is worried is, you can say anything is, that you say all things are consistent, if you're consistent, then you're the same type of thing as worried where all things are function of instinct. Can you just explain anything?
Well, yeah, that's the point. Since you can't explain anything, the question is there a good enough explanation? Since this is a way of exhibiting unity and consistency across a whole set of behaviors, we can now look at this and say, okay, let's give it all the room in the world. Let's optimize this. Let's suppose that there is a single cardinal trait with everything hanging so that in trait terms, it's completely consistent. And could we, with that system, get at the kind of consistencies that we take to be the case and would want to talk about?
No. What do we want to talk about? What kind of
consistencies? Well, that's the first question you want to ask yourself. What kind do we want to talk about? This? Well,
content predetermined.
Yeah, it's ambiguous because remember that was a neuropsychic structure. And since it's partly psychic, and this is the psychic part, you could say, well, it's not so much deterministic as tautological. Yeah, but then the behavior is nothing other than the expression of the trait. So in that sense, the behavior is not something separate from the trait, and therefore talking about the trait causing it is not entirely legitimate. Yeah, but he talks about it both ways. As I say, it's sufficiently equivocal here by virtue of being a neuropsychic organization so that you can assimilate the behavior to the organization and say, no, the organization doesn't cause the behavior is part of the organization. Or you can sequentialize it and say the organization causes the behavior. One thing you do not have is an energy mechanism, the way you had in Freud, where you could clearly say, this thing over here is activated and it results in behavior. Here you have behavior and the sources of behavior tied much more closely. And it's not entirely unambiguous whether that's a causal one or a logical one. So if you were an Allportian, you would probably keep the logical relation. And if you wanted to criticize him, you'd criticize him by saying that looks like determinism, and he'd want to deny that. Well, back to the question of what kind of consistency do we want to talk about? And let me set you the problem of taking some actual behavior and trying it out in this form. And this will serve as a preliminary exercise for when you do Fritz and Gloria in this form. Consider a chessboard and a chess game and say, okay, there's a miniature arena. There's a kind of real life behavior. And this behavior has the advantage of, we know darn well that there's a certain kind of consistency there. And furthermore, we not only know that there is a consistency, we know what consistency it is. So that makes it a good test case for asking, okay, since we know all this about it, will what we know about this behavior, can we do justice to it by using this kind of framework for showing consistency? Well, you don't have to suppose that you're going to reach all the way up. Just some set of these will do the job. See, if you can account for everything that happens, say, within something like this, then you can say, well, it's a wide open question what cardinal trait is there, because we haven't seen enough behavior to tell. Well, how would you give that kind of descriptions of what's going on in the chess game?
There's a main theme of the game, and that is to capture the other person's king. And then there are...
How about that? This is the analog to need achievement, except it's need for checkmate.
and then there are sub goals such as outnumbering the other, capturing more of his pieces.
Okay.
That's
instrumental in general. Okay.
Position. What position?
Be a little more specific.
Like you said, there are thrusts and line flows there, where it's more advantageous to be, at least to control. And then there are individual
dwarfs.
Or not to them.
Well, how about defending? And then particular sorts of moves. And then you can talk about not merely defending, but attacking. And then. Temporizing. Or waiting moves. Then you can talk about various strategies. And you can talk about styles, including defensive, aggressive, cautious, etc. How would you, that's probably best. Yeah. Well, now notice, all of those are kinds of description of behavior. Therefore, they would be candidates for a kind of behavior, therefore a kind of trait.
And I'm not sure if I can do it. Irrespective of the person, their nature of the game.
No, the
person who behaves hostily in chess might not behave hostily in chess.
That's okay. We're just considering this as a miniature of a person's entire life. This is a limited arena in which he engages in a lot of behaviors. So if that's all we had to go by, that would indeed be a sample of a fair number of behaviors, among which we would now look for consistency, etc.
But most people behave that way playing chess.
Well, no, because these are individual differences. Some people will be defensive, others will be aggressive. Some will control certain lines, but others will control others. Some will concentrate on defending, others will concentrate on attacking, etc. There are all kinds of things here. The probably the single most common one is that they're both trying to checkmate. But some people won't even do that. They're concentrating on defending and they're not really trying to checkmate. But at any rate, you can see these are clearly relevant forms of description of that behavior, of the kind of behaviors, the set of behaviors, or particular behaviors there.
How do you equate that to the cardinal?
Well, this is probably your best candidate for the cardinal trait. But let's not worry about cardinality yet. As I said, we don't even have to achieve that. All we have to do is be able to organize these in some kind of relation like this, and then use the whole set to explain particular behaviors as expressing some degree of each of these traits. As I say, every time you can describe a behavior in a certain way, you've got a candidate for a trait description. And some descriptions are more general than others. Some fit together, like defending, attacking, temporizing, so they would be this kind of thing. Others are of a different order, like outnumbering versus strategy, or strategy versus style. So you have here the ingredients of, you know, pretty much the general possibilities in this whole scheme. You have some very specific ones here. You have some very general ones here. You have things that relate, they're clearly related. You have things that clearly are not that related. And if you look at all of these, they fairly well cover the kinds of things that we say about chess behavior. By the time we have all of these down, it's getting pretty hard to think of a different kind of description. Now, how about organizing these in this kind of term and then using this form of explanation, namely that a given one of these chess behaviors is the outcome of the operation of some number of traits with some differential weighting. That a particular chess behavior represents the operation of some number of these different traits at different levels and given different weighting. So some of those traits are more important in determining the behavior than others are.
Still related to chess, right?
Yeah. Using which? Kind of. See, that's what we're looking at here, is it good enough? It's pretty clear that you can give account of the moves in terms of reasons. And this is a very different, at least apparently very different thing. That's why there's a point in trying out what would you get if you took this seriously and tried it out on a very well-known sort of behavior.
What direction do you want to go from small to large? Means to check me or from check me?
Well, you can probably do it either way. Think of the kind of descriptions that you'd be inclined to give if you were watching a chess game, and you'll probably want to start with these things and go from small to large.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
I'm clear. It looks like a lot of behaviors equal to trait, and a lot of traits equal to behavior.
Well, remember, the way you decide that the trait is there is because there's a corresponding behavior that appears often enough for you to say there's a trait that accounts for that regularity. On the other hand, when you see one of those behaviors, you say the behavior occurs because there is a corresponding trait that it is the expression of. So indeed, you have that convertibility. But that's why we gave ourselves all of these behavior descriptions and said for every one of these, there's a potential trait. And if you see a lot of any one of these, you'll say, well, that trait is an important one.
Okay.
And now this is the format for finally accounting for the behaviors that you see. That every behavior is the expression of some number of traits, which may be only one, but in general would be more than one, and with differential weights. That is, for a given behavior, they are more expressive of some traits than of others. And so, in principle, you could have a standard form in which every one of the traits was here for every behavior, and then allow yourself a zero value for the traits that don't really apply. No, because if you have that, you simply have the same problem of how does the first half of his chess behavior relate to the second half. You're still going to look for these kinds of things for the consistency that spans the entire one instead of just the first half or the second half. So if you can do it for this, in principle, you can extend it to the rest of his behavior. Well, look, take the history of the chess game here and say the consistency is that here, here, and here, he was behaving in a way that expressed, say, this. Whereas here, here, and here, he was behaving in a way that expresses this. And both this and this express this. So really, he was doing the same thing all the time. Yeah, but that is what by hypothesis, that's what he's doing all the time. So we can agree that what he's trying to do all the time is play chess, or he's trying to win at chess. The question is, how does that explain all of the particular things he does in playing chess? And we have this apparatus for drawing the connections. From the most general, namely, find a checkmate, to particular moves, or general strategies, or whatever. Somehow the whole thing hangs together. Or to put it differently, given this kind of arrangement, whatever the description of the cardinal trait is, you would have to eventually be able to say that he does X and he does Y, and by doing X and Y, he's doing Z, and by doing Z and Q, he's doing R. But no matter which of any of these he's doing, at all times, he is doing this. And since at all times he is doing this, his behavior is consistent.
Are you still talking within the one?
No, this is perfectly general. It doesn't matter in this arrangement whether you're talking about a 2-hour stretch of his life in which he's playing chess, or a 10-hour stretch in which he is playing chess first and then having dinner and then playing bridge and then going to bed, or a 50-year stretch of his entire life. The same logic will apply.
So normally he's always doing the same thing if you take it back to one level.
That's right. Well, that's the, but that's the nature of the consistency.
And then you're not saying anything about anything.
You're saying well, consistent. Now he's not doing the same thing. He's obviously playing chess at one time and eating dinner at another time. But it's all in the same
at
same
one level, well, though, he's always doing the same thing because it all boils up to that kind
okay.
of thing.
Well, that's part of what's involved here. Hey, but look, that's part of what's involved in this kind of logic. That you have to be saying, even though he's doing different things under these descriptions, he is also really doing the same thing. And therefore, the apparent heterogeneity is only apparent because he's really doing the same thing all the time. So the problem is not consistency per se, but consistency in the face of apparent heterogeneity. And if we didn't know chess as well as we do, and you know it was a strange game that we'd never seen before, we would indeed have the problem of you know, what are they doing during these 2 hours? Have they played one game or three? Etc. See, it's because we know chess that we already know some of the answers, and particularly we know that this one is going to have to be the cardinal trait if anyone is. But if I introduce a strange game and just gave you some descriptions of performances, you would really have the same kind of task as if you were going to describe somebody's life. Namely, you wouldn't have the guarantee that there is any cardinal trait.
Each time you took a piece, you could think, well, he won that game.
Yeah, right.
He played about 30 games.
And
it looks like they're going to have to keep it back on the keyboard.
Yeah. Well, see, that's why it's nice to have an example where we don't have that kind of uncertainty, and therefore we can devote our attention to what's the adequacy of this way of describing that behavior, because we don't have any of the technical problems, the merely technical problems of giving that kind of description. Well, yeah, you can translate this into symbolic significance, but not the other way around. But again, what we're testing is this way, this kind of logic, this way of talking, in a known sort of situation where we have no doubt that we understand it. And therefore are able to say, is our understanding adequately expressed by talking about consistency this way? We know it's consistent. Can we express what we know about the consistency talking this way? Well, that's how you decide which trait is cardinal, is by frequency. Well, I'm sure it would turn out to be a major appropriate striving. Yeah. Over time, that's what determines which things are more important motivationally, value wise. Yeah. But don't worry about circularity because all of these are circular. Okay. To begin with, any questions from last hour? Recall last time we talked about the hierarchical organization of traits. And the way that this hierarchy is an answer, Allport's answer to consistency in people's lives, consistency across different behaviors, consistency across visibly different behaviors. Any question about the notion of a trait as an individual difference notion of that sort? Notice that for Allport, the notion of a trait does several jobs. One, it's the general notion of behavior. And two, it's a primary individual difference notion. And three, it takes care of the issues of motivational priorities. Even though he also has a notion of values in there, the hierarchy of traits is also a motivational hierarchy. Well, at the end of the hour, we discussed the question of just what you can do with a hierarchy of the sort. And I set you the exercise of taking a chess game. We had on the board a list of the kinds of descriptions that you could give. What are some of those descriptions again? Refer to your exercise and let's have a few descriptions that would serve either as traits or as behaviors.
Of chess, yeah. Offense or defense, that need to check various kinds of strategies. Queen to bishop, pawn, bishop left, or something like that.
Any other interesting ones?
The temporizer?
Colloquially known as waiting moves, where you just make an inconsequential move waiting for the other person to develop his position so that then you know what to do. Now, the task was to use these kinds of notions in an Allport type format, which we have a remnant of here. And I said that you would wind up giving descriptions in this form, namely to take a given behavior and express it as the outcome or the expression of some number of traits differentially weighted. You wind up making statements of the form behavior X is to this extent an expression of trait 1, to that extent an expression of trait 2, and to that extent an expression of trait 3, etc. Now, just to fancy it up, you could put it in the form of a matrix where for every behavior, you've got a number. It expresses to what extent this behavior is an expression of that trait. And as I said, if you put it in this form, clearly some of these will be zeros. But that gives you a general format for considering simultaneously all of a person's traits, all of a person's behaviors. It's simply a question of organizing them so as to say which behaviors are expressions of which traits and to what extent. And so a natural current form of expression of that would be a matrix of this sort. Incidentally, if you've read the factor analytic approach, you'll find things of this sort in there. Now, what actual examples do we have of behaviors in this form? Take a given behavior, like it's certainly one of the possible descriptions of behavior. And let's say that's the first move, or it's just one of the moves. Now you say, okay, this behavior is what? Well, it's an expression of some number of these considered as traits. For example, it may be an expression of strategy X. It may be an expression of an offensive, being on the offensive. It may be an expression of an aggressive style of play. It could. But let's just pick some, make it sort of plausible.
The kind that you're putting into this is an act. So we've got an actual chess game, and now here's the move. Mm-hmm. Which one of those?
Yeah, see, conceivably it might be any of these, but in fact, any given move in an actual game wouldn't be an expression of all of these. So let's pick some that are more or less plausible. And it might be an effort to control certain areas or lines on the board. So let's stop with those. Say, let's suppose the other ones are near enough to zero so that they don't really matter that much. How would we now express it so as to understand this behavior? Well, let's give these numbers. Shall we give them numbers or proportions? Do the proportions have to add up to one or what? I think we better not have them add up to one. Yeah, let's give them numbers on a scale from 0 to 9. And say, let's see. Nine, six, seven, and 2.
You're just sort of setting arbitrary numbers. How would you be able to?
We're just setting arbitrary numbers because the theory allows for differential contribution. We can express the differential contribution by assigning numbers.
How would you know what it was?
You'd have to decide. You'd have to decide. For example, the more that you see offensive moves, the more you're going to assign large numbers to the behavior or to the trait in relation to the behaviors that are offensive. Well, let's see. This behavior then equals
Thank you.
similar to all the others.
Yeah.
Even though they may be higher on the hierarchy.
No, we're just hypothesizing an actual example in which these are the numbers that you would assign. As I said, in the abstract, any of these could apply to a given behavior.
The way that we described it, for example, need for check would range above all the others of it.
Not necessarily.
No.
A person may be more preoccupied with these right now than with this. So let's give this a three.
So, but it could be zero if they weren't at that moment interested in.
For example, if you're just interested in saving your height here, you're not at all thinking in terms of checking.
Right.
Okay. Okay, now, here we have a description in the proper form where these are considered traits. And you'd have to do some English language rewording to make them sound like traits. For example, here you'd say aggressiveness or offensiveness or something like that. It's harder to do with strategy and control.
You could say need for control.
Or tendency to control, tendency to control, tendency to use strategy Z. Well, is there any question about this being the form of the description that goes with the hierarchy of traits and that way of accounting for behavior? Notice I put a question mark because it isn't really clear what you would put there. What you would put there is the English word and, I guess, which is sufficiently neutral to leave you whatever leeway you need here.
In what way does that provide for hierarchy?
You'd have to do this repeatedly for B1, B2, etc. And then see which of these appeared in the various behaviors, and then you'd construct your hierarchy. And let's suppose that we've done that. And up here is checkmate. And down here is strategies, X, Y, Z. And here is capturing. And here is exchanging. And here is controlling. Okay, so we would be able to arrange these terms in something like this if we looked at the entire sequence. So let's suppose that we've done that and we have those. Now what?
Well, that would be done by, say, total numerical strength.
Yeah. Numerical strength and frequency. So we not merely have a description of a given behavior. The terms of the description themselves are organized over here.
So under a significance kind of thing, you're saying by doing that thing, you're doing a little bit of this, more of this, more of this, more of that, something like that.
Remember, significance is not part of this setup.
Where do you get it?
Huh?
It seems like it's really important.
You get it in inverse form by saying this is an expression of these. So it's kind of hard to reverse the English and say doing this is a way of doing that, because these are not behavior descriptions. These are traits. See, in significance, both ends of it are behaviors, and so you can say doing X by doing Y. But this is more like the relationship formula, where you have to say that the behavior is an expression of something that isn't the behavior. Remember, in defining the ID parameter of intentional action, we said the ID parameter, the value of it, is the ID characteristics that the behavior is an expression of. So the relation of ID characteristics and behaviors is that the behaviors are expressions of the ID characteristics. And because of that, you can't do the required grammatical work to have a significance formulation.
Yeah, that might seem like it might be kind of accurate if you're just looking out.
Yeah, you can say he's, by doing this, he's expressing this trait. By doing this, he's engaging in strategy Y.
The numbers though have to do with the kind of relationship of one of those things to the other on this of the way he explains.
Well, here you see, if things are mutually exclusive, there is a limit to how they can be related to this hierarchy. There's a limit to how they can be related, and there's a limit to the kind of frequency that you can have in both of them. They're mutually exclusive. You can't have 100% in both cases. They're mutually exclusive. See, the frequencies in both of them together can only be 100%. So logical relations will appear as constraints on either where the descriptions appear here or in the kind of frequencies that are possible.
Maybe there's an extension of what you just said, but if, let's say, this chess game is taken as a whole as a certain behavior, and if would all chess games follow this certain pattern of traits then, in terms of should they all chess games then for this person playing chess, if there is a set hierarchy and consistency?
No, it doesn't follow that. It might be that if you added 20 other chess games, you'd have a few more turns here for the same person. There's no implication that the traits that show up in a given game will also show up in all the other games, that no new ones will show up. Any more than there's a guarantee that the traits that show up in the first half of the game will show up in the second half.
It's not set in the system whether a behavior consists of 100% of these certain traits that make up 100%, or whether you can have the person doing full strategy and full offensive at the same time.
There's no limit set. You could have a 9 in more than one place. Because we don't want to constrain this any more than Allport's discursive presentation constrains it, and there's certainly no constraint of that sort. See, what we've done is make it more precise by introducing numbers, etc., but those are clearly warranted in what he says, the degree to which a trait is expressed by a given behavior. But as to constraints on the numbers, he would have to engage in some fancy prose to put in that kind of constraint, given that he didn't talk about numbers at all. Well, okay, here's the form of description that you wind up with. And the question is, will this form of description enable you to express what you understand is going on when people play chess? Well, I'm not sure it doesn't look. Compare it with this set. and then think of the zero things as being possible reasons that do not enter into the judgment. Think of all of these as corresponding to reasons for doing it. And then think of these numbers as the strengths of the reasons. And you could do a reasonably good job then of getting at certain facts of judgment, at least, via these. Maybe. That's what he was doing by doing that. He was expressing these traits. Well, because from there you go back to over here and the relative importance of them.
But you didn't have that. I didn't see it that we had arranged the three.
By looking at a whole series of behaviors and then counting the way he says. You find out practically every behavior on that chessboard reflects this one. And 2/3 of them reflect this, and 3/4 reflect this. See, that's how you arrange them up here.
If you did the same thing for another chess game for the same individual, you should get the same hierarchy.
No.
You should.
You'd be surprised if you got something markedly different. But there's nothing in the theory that says that any sample of behavior is completely representative of any bigger sample. And if it said that, it would be demonstrably wrong.
The behavior of P, Q3 in the next chess game, same behavior, it's not.
Well, it's the same behavior under this description, but it doesn't have to express any of these traits. Oh, because of the person playing. Somebody who moves here might have strategy Z and be doing it in a defensive way and be concentrating on exchanging rather than controlling and have it be a temporizing move. So for a different player in a different game, this doesn't have to express any of these. Got a lot of flexibility in this.
But you can never really talk about the individual moves outside of this kind of, you know, I don't know if that would even be important, but you're always talking of something in terms of something else.
Well, you're talking about these things, but then remember, according to the conceptualization, these are exactly the things that produce this. Remember, it's these traits that initiate and guide this form of adaptive and expressive behavior.
You couldn't talk about an intrinsic social practice.
No.
Kind of leaves you.
Are two people who, I just made part of that other question, but are two people who, for whom you can figure out the same subcategory, but doing the same thing?
Well, it's unlikely that any two people would have all of the same set of numbers for every, all of the same traits, and all of the same numbers, and exactly the same hierarchy.
Okay, but I'm wondering about that. I can appreciate the Bolinkian reasoning, but what about the same?
See, and this is where you get the specific issue of uniqueness for all parties. Says, given this. Everybody is different, really different, because these are going to be different. Everybody's traits are unique, and you can only compare them if you gloss over some of the differences.
I don't see how the cognizance parameter is taken care of. Traits can be expressions of,
Well, that's really taken care of by a different part of the theory, which is the self and the appropriate functions. One of the appropriate functions is the function of knowing. And the connection to this is not obvious in the theory, because it's not a very systematically formulated. But it's clear that if you're talking about self-knowledge, there is some part of the theory that talks at least about knowledge. And then there is Allport's practice and his motto, which is, if you want to know something about a person, ask him first, which implies that he's clearly seeing people as having self-knowledge. There isn't much in the theory to show that people have self-knowledge and not merely knowledge. There isn't much in the theory beyond the bare fact that people have knowledge. So you might say, given that the theory is that spotty and unstructured, it does allow you to talk about self-knowledge, but it certainly, you wouldn't say the theory generates that or illuminates it or anything of that sort.
It's not clear beyond the theory what function without self-knowledge, because you wouldn't know what the traits were. But the behavior itself would give you not very many clues as to what the traits were, unless you asked the subject what his intentions were or something of that nature.
Well, you might be restricted in the kind of descriptions you'd be willing to give, but we do that. For example, when we talk about animals, we don't generally talk about their intentions, partly because we can't ask them. Yeah. But we do indeed go ahead and describe regularities and talk about their traits and sometimes their attitudes, etc. Remember, the definition of those only depended on having some type X behavior, and it did not have to be deliberate action. Therefore, you can construct trait descriptions out of behaviors where there is no self-knowledge.
Oh, then maybe I'm just generalizing too much from these traits here, because they involve outcomes.
Chess games, you expect self-knowledge.
Yeah.
But again, remember, this is an example. It's not built into the theory that all behavior involves self-knowledge.
We could generate a list of traits in a chess game that involve sequences of moves.
That's the strategy.
Yeah. But traits like capture or control involve intentions.
Well, you would think so.
Yeah.
And you might, if you did, you would be unwilling to give that.
That's right.
But then, if it wasn't a human being, you'd hesitate to say he's playing chess at all. You'd more likely say he's making moves or something like that, or he's moving pieces on a chessboard.